And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
It looks like your luggage is over 50 pounds. Is there anything you can take out?
Oh, yeah. Let me just toss all these $20 bills.
Great. Let me grab you a trash can.
Stop. Instead of throwing money away, move some clothes into a carry-on. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Kate Blanchett returns to talk about one of the performances of the year in Tar. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. And yeah, it sounds crazy to me too to say Kate Blanchett returns, but it's true. She is now a returning guest to Happy, Sad, Confused, and it's a great occasion to have just one of the best actors on the planet. She stars in the remarkable new film from Todd Field, He of Little Children and In the Bedroom fame. It's his first film in 16 years. The film is Tar. It's in limited release right now, and it is extraordinary. And Kate's performance in a career filled with amazing performances, it could be her best, and that speaks volumes. Okay, we'll get into the Kate Blanchett side in a second, but let me just update you on what else is going on in Happy, Sad, Confused and Josh Horowitz land, which is a lot. So I'm taping this just on the other end of New York Comic Con and Paley Fest, which I think actually is still going on in New York City. It's just a series of events at the Paley Center. All of which is to say, I saw a lot of you out there, a lot of kind words from folks I ran into. I moderated 4 different events in a couple days. It's been insane. But what fun. It was so, you know, I'm moderating more than ever, and I love it. I love seeing the fans and feeding off that energy. And I got a chance to talk about some really great projects. And just in brief, I'll mention them because they're all shows and films that I want to give some love to. In no particular order, I moderated the panel for The Peripheral, which is a new Amazon Prime series from Jonah Nolan and Lisa Joy. That is another great kind of bit of heady sci-fi. They, of course, made Westworld. This one comes from William Gibson's work, and it stars Chloe Grace Moretz and Jack Rayner, who I both adore. Great to catch up with them in person. That was super fun, and that we debuted a bunch of footage from that. That's coming soon on Amazon Prime. Let's see. Then we did, I'll save the biggest, craziest one for last. I did a Lord of the Rings event with the cast of Lord of the Rings at Paley Center. And what a treat to see this cast. It was 7 members of the cast who I'd all seen at San Diego Comic-Con before the show even premiered. And that back then, they couldn't say anything about the show. And now, having seen 7 episodes thus far, really fun to sort of dig into what that show is and those brilliant characters and that high degree of difficulty that Lord of the Rings of Power is. So I don't know if you guys have caught up on it, but it's a massive undertaking, and I think they're doing a great job, and I'm excited to see the finale, which is this week, and they're already in production on season 2. I think there are 5 seasons that are planned. They do have a plan. There's all this, you know, we complain about these movie series and TV series that don't kind of have open-ended plans. They have a plan, so that speaks volumes. I moderated the panel. I've mentioned this movie before, but I want to give it some love again. Coming November 4th on Roku, you guys have to check out Weird, the Al Yankovic story. It is a biopic like no other. Definitely reflects the vibe of Weird Al. Very funny movie. And I got a chance to moderate that panel at New York Comic Con with Daniel Radcliffe and Evan Rachel Wood. And Al Yankovic, Weird Al himself, joined us via satellite Zoom, whatever technology we were using, I don't even know. But that was a treat. And just look, we'll mark that movie down because it is such a crowd pleaser, and it's going to be for free on Roku. And, well, you know, nothing to complain about that. And I guess the last one I want to mention, because personally this was a big one, and I do get a chance to moderate a bunch of events, and I try not to be jaded about all of it, and this one was impossible to feel jaded about. I hosted the Star Trek Universe panel at New York Comic Con, And not to digress too much, but Star Trek was kind of the first geek love for me. It really was. I went to Star Trek conventions when I was a little kid in New York City. I stood on line for Gene Roddenberry's autograph. I did it all. And to be there full circle for this panel in which we covered Star Trek Discovery, with the cast and creators of that. Star Trek Prodigy had Kate Mulgrew there. Amazing. Of Voyager fame. So awesome. And then culminating, guys, if you're a Star Trek fan, you're going to feel the same way I do. We reunited the cast of Next Generation on stage. And it was bananas. They're all in the third season of Picard coming soon. So it was, let's see if I remember it all. I think I should. Patrick Stewart, LeVar Burton, Gates McFadden, Marina Sirtis, Jonathan Frakes. Who am I leaving out? Brent Spiner, Michael Dorn. Am I leaving somebody out? I might be. I think that's it. It was amazing. It was amazing. And the energy in the room was remarkable. How often do you get that group together on one stage? Will it happen again? I don't know. But it was a real honor and a privilege to be there. And I tried to very much embrace the moment. And there was so much love in the air about Star Trek, which, you know, as we kind of talked about Trek throughout this long panel, the themes of family kept coming up. Rod Roddenberry, who's Gene's son, still very much a key component of that creative team. And to hear him talk about passing it on to his son, LeVar Burton talking about his daughter appearing in the new season of Picard. So, it just it really spoke volumes to like what Trek has been and continues to be over decades, and to see it continue was really heartwarming. So, all of which is to say, it's been busy, guys, and I have no complaints. I love it. I'm really honored that I've been asked to host so many great events. I'm looking forward to a little bit of a break for a second, but not for too long, because in the show notes, check out the upcoming live Happy, Sad, Confused events, and we've got a bunch of them coming. I'll rattle them off. October 25th, Symphony Space, is Ralph Macchio talking about waxing on his new memoir. October 26th, we've officially announced it, me and Henry Cavill. Yes, Henry Cavill. And there will be a lot to talk about, guys. Trust me. I'm not going to say too much, but there will be a lot to talk about. Enola Holmes 2, and a lot more. And then, this is an exciting one. November 11th. This is at 92Y, as is Henry Cavill, by the way. Sylvester Stallone, and his showrunner for his new series on Paramount Plus, Tulsa King, Terrence Winter, of Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire fame, writer of Wolf of Wall Street, will join me. So hi, Stallone, guys. Talk about a living legend. So lots of opportunities to see me and some amazing guests in person in New York City. There are virtual options for all those shows. So check it out in the show notes. You know what to do. Go to patreon.com/happysadconfused to get early access, discount codes, all the good stuff. And check out our YouTube channel as well, youtube.com/Josh Horowitz. Woo, a lot going on, right? Okay, back to Cate Blanchett. I'll toss this conversation momentarily, but just a tiny bit more context. This film that she's promoting, one of my very favorites of the year. It will definitely be in the top 10, if not top 5, if not top 2 or 3, I don't know. I've seen it twice. It's fantastic. It is a probing character study of a very flawed woman who is a conductor composer of very high esteem and accomplishment, who is basically at a crossroads, and her past is catching up to her. And it has been very well reviewed, and justifiably so. This performance will blow you away. She is, for what it's worth, currently, I don't know, probably the front runner to win Best Actress, but that can change. Who cares? Bottom line is, it's a great movie. She's fantastic in it. I caught up with Cate Blanchett the day she was in New York City for the New York Film Festival premiere. We contextualize that. We say that in the conversation. It was the morning of that film festival premiere. And I'd gotten a chance to actually see Cate Blanchett a couple weeks prior, again, just saying this because it comes up in the conversation, I saw her at the Telluride Film Festival where the film screened as well. So that's some context around that. There's a little bit of spoiler-ish talk in here, but I do reference it and give you ample warning. But there's some great stuff in here about her life and career, and her many notable roles, and a lot on this fantastic performance in Tar, which if you love film, you've probably already prioritized this one. And if not, do so right now. My highest recommendation. Okay, let's get to the main event. I know this is a long preamble, but it's been a lot going on. I'm going to go lie down and go to bed because I'm tired. It's just too much. You have a task at hand to listen to one of the world's greatest actors on the planet talk about their craft and their career. Here is me and Kate Blanchett.
You know, I've been married to my husband for 25 years, almost 26 years, and he will not let me make him tea.
The boundaries. This is the limit.
Obvious reasons.
So we're just coming into this very important conversation where Kate has mangled her tea procedure.
Yes.
Apologies for...
It's a daily occurrence, mangled tea procedures.
The good news is you're much better at acting than your tea procedures.
Yes. I hope so.
You're quite good. Congratulations. Yeah. It's good to see you again. We were just talking. We caught up briefly in Telluride. We both drank the Kool-Aid. We're in for that festival. That's amazing.
You just said it was your first. It was my first, too.
Remarkable. And now we're here in New York. You're on my home turf. Thank you for coming. And today's a big day. As we tape this, this is the premiere at the New York Film Festival for Tar, this exceptional piece of work. Before we get into Tar, I'm just curious. You've done so many different kinds of premieres in your career. what stands out as, like, I don't know, walking into a premiere with expectations, worry, anxiety? Is it always, like, what's your secret to a chill premiere?
Well, the longest premiere that I ever went to, the Mahabharata of premieres, was when was for The Hobbit in New Zealand, and Pete and Fran said it's a long red carpet. It was literally I think it was about 2.5 miles long.
So the red carpet is proportional to the film. So
no, proportional to the population of New Zealand. They wanted to allow every single member of the New Zealand population to have access to the actors. So
welcome New Zealand. And we don't mean just metaphorically. We mean literally welcome all of New Zealand to the premiere.
So that was a long one. But, you know, when we showed the film for the first time in Venice, I find it excruciating to watch myself, but Todd has made an exceptional film, and you know, the ensemble of actors, you know, Nina Hoss, for instance, is so extraordinary. I could watch her, you know, read the phone book. But I find it increasingly important to watch these things with an audience, because you have no idea how it's going to play, and then you have to let it go. But it's very nerve-wracking.
Well, this is one, and I've seen it a second time since Telluride, and it plays, I mean, in so many fascinating different ways. It's a sticky film. I mean that in that...
It's called Tar.
I didn't even mean that metaphor, but thank you for that. But no, it does. It really, like, it sticks with you in the best possible ways, and it's going to conjure a lot of different conversations. Mm. It's at its heart, it's a character study, a fall from grace of this amazing figure, this complex figure, Lydia Tar.
It's interesting you say fall from grace. I think the first time I read it, I found the descent, you know, a bit like Orpheus going down into the underworld, really dark and confronting. But then in playing it, I feel like there's a kind of an epiphany or a rebirth. It's a little bit of an inkblot test. I mean, I don't want to give away the ending, but where it gets to, look, it's a meditation on power in a lot of ways, but it's also the corrupting nature of power. You don't have to be a classical musician to understand that. But I think it's also about the creative process, and that we talk about giving birth to ideas or giving birth to you know, works of art, whatever that, in whatever form that may be. But the urge to destroy that is equally as powerful.
It's interesting you say that, and maybe we'll put a little spoiler alert on this part of the conversation, because I wasn't planning on going there, but what you bring up is something that I was thinking about, especially the second time I watched it, which is the way the film ends. She's not destroyed. Like, she is.
You can stop listening now if you haven't seen the movie.
We'll skip by this. For those that are, we'll skip ahead a couple minutes. Okay. But she still has the same certitude and passion for the work at the very end.
There's a humility I think. And we don't associate that with positions of power. And I think what I find really interesting, particularly because she's a classical musician, you know, she's a composer, she's a pianist, but she's also, you know, a conductor of the greatest orchestra of all time. So, you know, the fact that a woman is leading it, you know, it is a bit of a fairy tale in that respect. But, you know, she's had to invent her own origin story.
Yeah.
And I think because in classical music world, your connection to your mentor, to the history of the music, and therefore your unassailable right to be able to perform it and reinvent it. You know, if you look at Marin Alsop and her connection to Bernstein and Bernstein's connection to Mahler's widow, you know, like it's, or his sister, I can't remember which, that gives them the right to reinvent the music.
Right.
And of course, we discover that the Tar's sense of her history is not what she says it is.
Yes.
You know, so she's very estranged from herself.
It's a masterful kind of masked exposition in the first like act that Todd does, I think. Todd,
yeah, the prologue, I like to think of it. Yeah.
Yes. So the prologue is this extended sequence, this like interview from the West and Adam Gopnik that could feel like an exposition dump, but it really is very telling for exactly
exposition dump.
No, but it could in the wrong hands, in the wrong like treated. But it says so much because you're right. Like we see her assistant mouthing the bio, and we realize, oh, this is
constructed. Yeah.
This is totally constructed by her. I mean, the facts may be the facts to a different degrees, but this is a meticulously created world she's created for herself. This like hermetically sealed world that that really, I guess, then the whole film is a bit of a slow burn on like of that world getting destroyed, of getting holes poked in it.
And I think, you know, conductors in particular, but I think a lot of people in the public eye, you know, whether they be an architect or the CEO of a major banking corporation, you know, but particularly with conductors, is that their personalities go a long way to cement their reputation.
Right.
And so what is said about you, because what you do, making music, it's ephemeral.
Right.
And that's why recordings are, you know, so important. You look at Von Karajan, you know, he was very obsessed with how music looked as much as how it sounded. And he would go into the recording studio and replay and film himself conducting.
Wow.
You know, so it's, you know, because he knew that that would be his legacy. Because if he just left it up to the concerts, then it once all of the people who had seen him live,
it's gone forever.
It's gone. I mean, that's what I love about theater.
Yes,
you know, you have to be there, and that's what is great about cinema too, particularly these days. If you don't see this film in the cinema, then you miss that experience.
So where are you at? You just talked about theater.
I'm right here, right now.
No, literally, where are you, Kate? I can't see you.
I'm over here.
Help! No, but I mean, you talked about theater, and that's part of the love of theater, which is that it is ephemeral and it's special. It's only for that 500 people at once. But, you know, are you the type that, I don't know, like Lydia keeps the clippings, keeps the memorabilia, keeps like is documenting every tangible part of her life?
I had this horrifying moment. The National Archives in Australia, and I can't remember whether it happened or not, they approached me to say, well, you know, do they want to archive stuff? And I went, oh, and I must have mentioned it to my mother. And one day a box arrived to my house, and it had kind of the dress that I'd worn to my dad's funeral, and pages and pages and pages, bound volumes of clippings. And that from when, you know, when I, the first interview I must have given, when I did Oleana coming out of drama school, David Mamet's Oleana. And I went, it was really horrifying. It was like looking at a dead limb.
It wasn't enjoyable? It didn't bring back the beautiful memories? No.
No. No, because it's so interesting, because I think, don't you find that the way we think about things that have happened in the past, the present influences how we remember them. And then when you get the stark reality of, I looked like that, I actually said that ridiculous, nonsensical sentence, you know, like it's we polish those things,
right?
You know?
One of the many talking points about this film I know will be, you know, how it reflects the cancel culture that we've been, you know, the world that we live in now. I mean, we're all going to relate to it in different ways. Like, personally speaking.
It's a texture, definitely.
Definitely. And I worked my first job out of school. I worked for Charlie Rose, and I know you were on Charlie a bunch of times.
Many times, yeah.
Right, and like so, like that it's a it really had me thinking about him, frankly, and thinking about folks that are canceled and what happens, literally the day after. Like you don't think, you know, like because we're seeing her in that moment of when it's over and going from the center of attention, and her world is perfect by her own standards in some ways, and then she's a pariah.
But she's also, she's haunted, I think. You know, it's a...
True.
There is a kind of creeping dread
of it catching up to her,
A strange haunting that's going on in the film, you know. And it's interesting you talk about cancel culture, because for me it's like, you know, that moment when mobile phones entered our lives, it changed the way we constructed narratives.
Right.
And I feel like we haven't even processed the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter and the idea of canceling people. But that is the world in which we live.
Yeah.
And the pandemic, you know, that. So even if a movie doesn't, a film, a story, a novel, a stage play, it doesn't, a work of art, doesn't directly, literally address those things, like the mobile phone influence narrative delivery, I think that all of these things that we're going through are textures in the way an audience perceives a movie.
Because it's our day-to-day. It's
what we're living with. So definitely you can't make a movie at now without those things being a reference point. And I think that that's where they sit in the movie. I think for me, it's a much more existential, metaphysical journey than it is a kind of a literal social commentary.
Do you think about, though, I mean, like, the character does talk about, I think at one point, of caring more about the work than the life of the artist. And I feel like it's something that we all kind of wrestle with. I've wrestled with as a lover of the arts when I learned that the person that makes the thing is not the, you know, the paragon of virtue that maybe I had dreamed when I was a kid. I'm good at separating it. You can't take away a filmmaker's works from me if
it's complicated,
right?
Isn't it? It's very complicated, and you know, I mean, the interesting thing I think the film really examines is who is the judge, because it's not just you know, I think there's such a phenomenal ensemble in this film of Todd's, because it's not just Lydia who is changed and altered, corrupted maybe, or emboldened by being in a position of authority of power. It's all the people who support her being in that position and need her to behave in a certain way, need her to keep them in the positions they are. We're all culpable in some way. Now,
absolutely,
that doesn't excuse outrageous behavior, but it doesn't mean it doesn't need to be examined. But I think it needs to be discussed with, you know, with a degree of mature, nuanced discussion. You know, it can't be dealt with in a soundbite.
So it's written, directed by the great Todd Field. This is his first film in 16 years.
Not because he's lazy.
Not because he's lazy.
He's just picky.
Picky, and it's tough to make good stuff from anyone.
I mean, you think about little children and in the bedroom.
Yeah.
I mean, I still remember moments, scenes, expressions, performances, and shots from those movies. He's so gifted.
So he says he wrote this with you in mind. How often does that happen, and how often does it work out when someone comes to you and says, I've written this for you and you're the only one?
Oh, well, they all say that, don't they? Well. And then 17 people have passed on it before it gets to your desk. I don't know. I mean, look, I didn't know that until I read the press notes in Venice, and I'm so grateful I didn't. I mean, that's a lot of pressure. And there was enough to be getting on with. There was so much to do to get to first base to even play the role. So,
well, what is the first step? Like, what's the first? Like, you get the script.
Panic.
Okay, so panic attack, and then the work begins. And what is the work? Is it a lot of different facets in approaching this?
Well, our conversation, Todd's and my conversation initially were intensely practical. Mm. It was, okay, so this is a 10-minute scene. How do you think you might shoot this? Okay, so is this the piece of Bach that you want me to play on the piano? Okay, so I need to get on top of that, because it's a teaching exercise. How can I play that? She's also composing something, and Hilda Grundotter did the music. I mean, she, you know, did an amazing score. People will know her from The Joker, but she's an incredible composer and cellist. And so she composed that. I had to learn that. I didn't know how much Todd wanted to use, so I had to be prepared. And then, of course, she's leading an orchestra in Germany. And I said to Todd, she's been there. Tara's been there for 7 years. She's not going to lead the rehearsal in English. She has to do it in German. He said, you said it. So then I had to pull out my German textbooks. But fortunately, I've got a very dear friend who's an opera singer. And she introduced me to this miraculous human being, Franziska Roth, who helps opera singers to sing correctly in German. So she knew the musical world, and so I spent a lot of time with her.
All right, so let's take a step back a little bit on some broader career stuff. I just had Matt Smith on. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He's fantastic.
Yes.
And he introduced me to a game called Movie Star or Actor. And he just brings up a thespian, an actor, and says, are they first a movie star or an actor? So Kate,
hang on, but I mean that you pulled a funny face. What is one good and one bad?
Well, that was my question for you. Is Kate Blanchett a movie star or actor? And B, is there a pejorative? Is there a negative connotation in your mind, like just a movie star? Like, I don't know. I mean, I revere both, and I think someone can be both, but I don't know.
I think that the notion of movie star it seems like an antiquated thing, but there's a light that some people have. And it's not about transformation. It's not about seeing the acting. They're luminous.
Yeah, holding the screen, holding our attention.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe the quality that people are talking about. And you're born with that.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting, too. You work with some actors and you think, are you doing anything?
Right.
But then you see them on the screen and there's a relationship or something that the camera brings out in them, which is just, it's so imperceptible. So it's a gift. It's a gift.
When you came out of drama school, were movies on your mind?
No, I was never that girl. I was never, no. I thought if I was lucky, I would have a career in the theater, which I was very, very happy with working in Australia. I didn't ever think that I would make a movie or do any television or even travel with my work.
So obviously, you know, we're going to skip around because we don't have time to do everything. But like Elizabeth was a turning point that changed things seemingly in terms of your visibility around the world. Safe to say, no, maybe not.
Maybe.
Lucinda prior to that?
Yeah,
or?
Maybe externally it might have seen that. For me, though, a big turning point was in my final year at drama school, I played Electra. And by default, actually, not by design, it was kind of a really complicated situation where another girl was quite painful, actually. She didn't perform the role and I did. And that was transformative for me. And then when I came out of drama school, so many people in my year worked and I don't think anyone knew what to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized I sort of had to work out what to do with myself.
Got it.
And I got cast in David Mamet's Oleana, and sure. that was for me a big turning point.
Because of the material, because you're working with Jeffrey on stage.
I guess because I just felt like I stopped thinking about myself. You know, because of course self consciousness is the enemy to getting anywhere as a performer. So that was
Was it clear to you though when Elizabeth came around that like. I mean, it's like a Michael Corleone kind of role, down to like her orchestrating the multifaceted attacks by the end. Did you see the capacity of what that could be matched with the director at the time?
I thought it was going to be the death of my career.
What?
Yeah, as nascent as it was at the age of, 27, I thought, you know. But I loved working with Shekhar Kapoor. And it was kind of like one of the first sort of Bollywood East meets West aesthetic hybrid. So, you know, I don't think I fully appreciated how that sort of shifted things at the time. It was just, I just thought, well, this is it. I have to enjoy it while I can.
Yeah.
And then I'll go back and you know, my first love, which is theater.
Oh, you've been able to do both, thankfully.
Lucky me.
I mean, it seems like next to talent, the best asset and luck perhaps an actor can have is good taste. And it's safe to say, I mean, looking at the directors you've worked with in your career, it's like looking at just a compendium of the greats of the last 50 years. It's in terms of reflecting also international cinema. And I guess I'm curious, I don't know, how do you select directors now? I guess you're selecting projects, not just directors, but I would imagine.
In the end, I think it's the director. I mean, there's been a few times where I've been so enamored with the script. And then the script has just been shot.
Right.
And that was a remarkable thing working with Todd. I mean, what doesn't that man do? I mean, we had the conversation. He was an actor.
Yes.
He was a jazz musician. He's a screenwriter. And I was totally entranced and bowled over by the screenplay of Fatar, and he's a director. And then we had this conversation the other day, and he was talking about going around and checking the theatres, you know, for when Tar comes out, because the sound is so important.
Audiences have also appreciated, especially some of, like, you know, the quote-unquote bigger franchise stuff that you've been a part of. I'm curious, like, the stuff like Lord of the Rings, Indiana Jones, etc., Thor, Ragnarok in recent years. Have those been influenced by your kids as much as your interest in the material itself? Like, do they factor into when you get involved in something that satisfies the popcorn side of things, or no?
I just felt like it was a genre that I hadn't worked in, and I was curious about. And obviously, doing something like Thor Ragnarok, it was to work with Taika.
Yeah.
You know, so once again, it was kind of director driven. Yeah. But yeah, partly. Like, you know, I did a voice in Guillermo's del Toro's Pinocchio, which comes out soon. And you know, I could say what a good parent I am that was for my children, but really it was to work with Guillermo.
No, hang out
again.
With Guillermo.
Yeah, of course. Who wouldn't want to do that?
And yeah, genius.
Yeah.
And do I have it right? You're completing that great Mexican trifecta of brothers, as it were, soon. Are you going to work with Cuarón?
Almost finished. Yes.
Oh, you're in the middle of it.
Yeah, we've kind of wrapped the first tranche in London.
Oh, so exciting.
Yeah.
It does seem like he's one of those filmmakers, storytellers that, again, like, has all the tricks in the toolkit, but it services a good thing. Like, it's ways that tell a story in a unique way. The way Iñárritu can do Birdman and explore, you know, a seemingly continuous shot, but it's for narrative reasons. Some people can just trot out the tricks for no reason.
Yeah.
But it does seem like you've taken some big swings with some great filmmakers. Like, I think of, like, Soderbergh.
Yeah.
On, like, Good German, which, you know, some people may have loved
or
hated.
Only three or four people saw it.
Saw it, I admire the big swings, and that must have felt like when he comes to you with that is part of the excitement. Like, yeah, we're going to go for it.
He is one of the genuine experimenters.
Yeah,
and he experiments. I mean, he's just obviously a technical master, but he's so inventive with the way films are distributed, released, and disseminated and consumed, as well as the way he tells stories. And so he's constantly shape-shifting and moving the form. He's, you know, he's so fascinating to talk to, and so the chance to work with him, and he came and did a play with us in, when my husband and I were running the Sydney Theatre Company, which was great.
Oh, cool.
Based on the Casey Anthony story, Top Mom.
He's somebody that, like, is so iterative. It's like every 18 months, it's like he's just going to do something he's never done before in a fascinating way. And it's just thrilling that, like, someone, because a lot of people lose that. And it feels like he's never going to be that.
No. And he's, you know, he's totally prepared to give it all away. Yeah. But he's so curious about, he can't help himself.
The legacy, so we were talking a little bit, Thor, I mentioned Lord of the Rings. I mean, the legacy of Galadriel and that character and those films must exceed your wildest expectations. I can only imagine, like, day one of shooting that, or when you took that on, versus what it, of how it just informs your life day to day, like, still being recognized and still being, kids generations from now will still know you for that role. I mean, it's a great thing. But, I mean, does that boggle your mind that it has had the staying power it did? Did you know from Peter's talent from day one that it had that capacity?
I mean, it was totally, of course, being a Tolkien fan, who isn't? But it was absolutely to work with Peter and Fran.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the draw. And so I wouldn't mind what I did, you know. And so But it felt like something, like, it wasn't really on anyone's radar.
Right.
And so I don't think any of us imagined that it was going to be, I knew it was going to be something amazing, but I didn't know it would have this sort of lasting impact.
Yeah.
But then, of course, he's an incredible filmmaker.
Yeah, folks, like, every year you hear about people, like, it's an annual tradition, I'm going to watch the entire trilogy over, like, a holiday. And you're part of something that will never go away. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there any curiosity about this new Lord of the Rings series, just to see what another actress does with a different incarnation of Galadriel?
I'm sure she'll be amazing. And how great that they're reexamining that story through her lens.
Yeah.
I mean, great. Yeah.
And in terms of, so we mentioned you're in the middle of working with Cuarón now. It does feel like you're working through the list of the greats. Like, and I know there's some that are even, like, haven't happened that you've tried, like Luca Guadagnino. There was talk of collaborating with him on Brideshead.
Yes, one day, I hope.
There's who else is coming up? That oh, I know you want to work with Pedro Almodovar.
Yes,
which again may or may not.
Yeah,
down the
one
road.
Day. I mean, we've been talking for 20 years about doing it, so you know some things take a long time.
So is that how it works? I mean, do you reach out to filmmakers that you admire and just sort of like, because Todd even started on a different project, right? It wasn't necessarily this.
Yeah, we met about 10 years ago, and we were talking about he was working on a screenplay with Joan Didion, and we met, and for one reason, I can't even remember why, it just didn't happen. But you stay in one another's orbit. Mm. You know, you encounter one another at an event, or, you know, you watch their movie, or you end up, your paths end up crossing, or they send you a script, but you're not available at that time, but you've begun a kind of conversation.
Right.
Sometimes those conversations are sporadic, but, you know, it doesn't stop you admiring what they do and being influenced by what they're doing, and, you know, absorbing, you know, what they do year in, year out, and then hopefully one day the stars will align and you'll find something to do together.
Is your attitude like, I mean, do you feel like you can work with any kind of director at this point, or do you need a specific, are there certain things that you need to hear from a director that earn your trust, I guess, at this point in your career? Like, what are you looking for in those initial conversations?
I think it's just it's the quality of conversation.
Yeah.
I think for me, it's I don't have a particular process. I think the work, the director, the you know, the material, the other actors, the location, all of that influences the way you work. I mean, in the instance of Tar, there were certain technical things that I just had to get on top of immediately. So I had to, but some roles are not like that. Sometimes you have to just show up and be alive and open to what's going to happen on the day. Sometimes you have to get super fit, you know, which is probably an important thing as you get a bit older. to exercise.
That's where the magical tea comes in.
The magical tea, which I've drunk so much of.
Well, I'm keeping you talking too much.
Yeah.
I heard you say something about Todd and this and that. He was really great about, you know, being willing to kill his darlings, that old phrase in terms of this. Like, it's surprising in some ways to me because the film feels very assured, and it clearly is. But it sounds like some ideas came and went, and if it wasn't working for whatever reason, he let it go,
The screenplay that he wrote was absolutely immaculate.
Yeah.
I thought, you don't have to change a syllable. I just have to try and rise to the occasion. But in the process of making it, I'd say, you know, this says in the big print here. And he went, oh, don't worry about that. And then you'd realize that the camera was here and you'd never imagined that it was going to be shot like that. But he was very open to ideas that came up in the moment, you know, to shifting and changing things. And as we shot one scene, he'd say, I think we need to do this other scene in one take because we've had a lot of intercuts and rhythmically, like he's such a rhythmic director.
Yeah.
And him and Monica Willey together, you know, astonishing editor, you know, worked with Haneke for years, you know, that they were very focused on the rhythm of the piece. And as a result, he warned me, you know, there was some sections, there was a big birthday party sequence because my character was turning 50, which I hear is a very big turning point for a person.
In theory.
Yeah, I have to remember that when I one day reach that.
Exactly. As two 35-year-olds, we can laugh about what that's going to be one day.
Oh, I just lost my bladder control. yeah. No, but it's so that was excised. Yeah. But he said, you know, don't worry. He said, because all of those elements are homeopathically in the movie. And I understood what he meant. Because the fact that all of us understood, like Nina Haas and I understood that there was that she was throwing a surprise party for my character, that it was a big deal that she was turning 50. That influenced the way we played the other scenes.
Yeah.
So whilst, you know, halfway through the shoot, he said, I really, really think, you know, because my character has an acute sensitivity to sound, she has misophonia. He said, I think, what have we really played into that? And we said, you know, that she came from an incredibly silent household, because I kept thinking she's a character who's been mercilessly bullied. And said, you know, she's a child of deaf parents.
Right.
And where does her relationship to her acute ability and incredible talent with sound sit with her? And that sort of went away, literally, but it was still a texture for me, you know?
Does it matter to you, like, where the camera is? Like, do you want to know? Because, again, when I was watching the film again, like, there's, like, an extended dialogue scene where the camera is like way back. It's on your back and the person you're talking to for the entire dialogue scene. Like we see none of your face. Does that matter to you? Does it affect your performance at all?
Well, one thing you learn working on stage is to act with your back. The Son of Saul. What an astonishing film.
Sure, that's right.
You were so inside that experience. Laszlo's film was amazing and so confident, you know, that Todd has an absolute confidence and mastery. He always knows where to put the camera. And it helps me enormously to know where it is, because then you know you know your relationship or the tunnel through which you're communicating with the audience. Right. I never want to lose that sense on film. But what he was very clear about from the beginning is he wanted, particularly in the rehearsal scenes, because it's a rehearsal movie, not a performance movie,
right,
when they're rehearsing the major work with Mahler's Fifth, is he really wanted it to feel like a fly on the wall. And I think that was all the way through. So I knew that the camera would have that quality quite often, which was useful to know in terms of the texture of the performance, I guess.
We're also seeing like those like kind of revealing moments, like I think the first full glimpse of your character early on in the film is you waiting in the wings about to go out and kind of doing some vocal exercises, kind of just getting into that space where she needs to be.
Yeah, getting in control of her tics and anxieties. Boy, I know that feeling backstage.
Well, I was going to ask, so what if I had a camera trained on you before you go on stage for a theatrical performance?
It wouldn't be pretty. But something I have learnt to tell myself is that my anxiety is actually excitement, because
right,
that, you know, that energetic quality is quite similar. So it's a sort of a confidence trick that you have to do, you know. But and I every time I go on, I just say, just remember the first moment, and then the everything else has to evaporate. You cannot end game, you know.
Have you ever blanked on stage? Has it ever just?
I think I have once, and it was just a moment where it was like everything dropped away,
right?
For a minute, and I realized I'd forgotten to breathe. I mean, that's most times, isn't it, when we forget anything, we're holding our breath.
Yeah.
So,
theater for you, as I said earlier, has been it's always going to be a part of your life. Clearly, I mean, it's not. Oh, I'll do this at some point.
As long as people will come and see me. Yes. Yeah. No. I love it as an audience member. You know, and the thing is, when you go and see a bad film, you know, or a film that disappoints you, or you know, you go, oh well. But when you go and see a terrible play, you go, I am never going back to the theater again. I hate the theater. And I love that about it, you know,
yeah,
because it's so, you know, we have a responsibility the audience leans in.
Yeah.
So an audience is not passive in the theater. Not that they're not saying that they are in cinema, but
well, they've made the investment, money, time. It's an endeavor, and they're going to.
But on the stage, I think what people are unaware of is that the audience will shift. The show will shift night to night depending on the audience reaction. Now you can guide them rhythmically to look at a certain part of the story, and that's part of the stage picture where to look. But you know, it's they do complete the evening.
When you were growing up, was it theater or film that influenced you, that inspired you first? Like less about the career, but just like what were the turning points? What are the moments when you think to your childhood that made you kind of fall in love with the arts?
Gosh, it's hard to say. I think. My first memory of thinking acting was an exciting and dangerous profession was I went to see a production of The Mikado, and Frank Thring, who you wouldn't know, but he was this extraordinary burlesque of a human being, and he was playing the emperor, and his moustache fell off, and he made some quip about, he looked at the back of the moustache, said, oh, made in Japan, and he put it back on, and I didn't quite get the joke because I was only six, but everyone laughed, and you realize that the wall had come down and that something genuine and real had happened, and that the audience just leant right in, and I thought, oh, I want to be up there.
Yeah. And 10 years and counting. She just started, folks. She's just getting started, Cate Blanchett. We're just in the beginning stages of the career. I mean, you must be so thrilled honestly.
But to be how old I am?
No. What I was going to say is...
It's just, not easy.
No, I know it's not easy. But what I was going to say, honestly, is the breadth of the work that continues. Because, like, it was probably ingrained on any young actress. Like, it's going to dry up. When you hit 40, it's over. Like, I feel like that's...
Oh, my God, yeah.
Right?
I mean, my husband said with absolute... I mean, I couldn't have a more supportive partner. You know, and he said, you know, when I came out in Elizabeth, he said, darling, enjoy this because you've probably got 5 years. And that wasn't a lack of confidence in my capacity. It was just the reality of what it was. And that has really shifted for women. I mean, my God, there's a lot to be said and a lot to do. I mean, look at what's going on in Iran at the moment, and women's right to choose. Forget an actress's career. I mean, you know, women's rights are in profound peril, but there has been advances in our industry.
And you're inspired, excited by stuff that's coming your way. You're working with Cuaron. I don't know if you're still going to work with Stiller on a project. That sounded interesting.
Yeah, that's exciting. I really admire Ben. Yeah. I think he's astonishing.
And what he's been able to do as a director.
Oh, my God. I mean, he's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Okay, more to come. It's a busy day.
Was this a part two? We're doing part one, part two.
We're doing part
hundreds. We're going to stay here all day.
Just settle in. We got the tea.
I'm going to call you sir.
I really appreciate the time. It's an exceptional piece of work. Tars, the film, everybody should check it out. As you said,
it's a masterful piece of direction.
It really
I think.
Is.
It's a real kind of welcome home for Todd. I think people will be. Think, oh my God, can you please just make a movie? Don't take another 16 years.
I know. Hopefully, yeah. Do what you can to get 5 or 6 we'll take. He can still take his time.
Yeah.
Congratulations and enjoy the moment in New York.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.